Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section. This is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I am pleased to bring to you Chapter 30, Perek Lamed of Sefer Yishayahu, the Book of Isaiah. As I mentioned in the previous chapter, Radak asserts that all of these connected chapters from Kaf Chet 28 and on were prophesied in the time of Ahaz, Chizkiyahu's father. In his introduction to our chapter, chapter 30, he tells us why. Nowhere does he find that during the time of Chizkiyahu, or in the time of Uzziah, the first of the kings, Yishayahu prophesies, does it say that the nation of Yehuda went to Egypt for help. However, I think that the Radak may have overlooked the coming of Tirhaka, the king of Cush, to battle against Ashur while Ashur was attacking the coastal towns of Yehuda, specifically Lachish and Livna. The king of Cush is actually the king of Egypt, because Egypt at this time, in 701 BCE, was controlled by the last pharaoh of the Cushite dynasty, that is the 25th dynasty. Cush being the land south of Upper Egypt, Upper Egypt being south of Lower Egypt for reasons which I'm not going to go into right now. And that land of Cush is modern-day Sudan, and perhaps if you follow the coastline down, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia. There were times of foreign control over Egypt, and these times are usually referred to as intermediate ages. But the kings of foreign countries, when they conquered Egypt, happily took on the title of pharaoh and the customs of the mighty Egypt, even the worship of the mighty Egypt. Tirhaka would actually only become king 10 years after the invasion, in 690 BCE, after being routed by Assyria on Yehuda's soil. We'll see that Tirhaka and Egypt under him did come against Ashur during Ashur's march, but was swiftly beaten and sent back home to Egypt with their tail between their legs. At the time, he was merely the general of the Egyptian/Cushite forces. He wasn't the king. However, the Torah, the Navi, calls him the king because by the time the book was written, some years after this battle, Tirhaka was or had been made the king of Egypt. The second proof of Egyptian involvement, and I'm not sure why the Radak doesn't notice this, is in Sanherib's Assyrian march against the Levant, when he actually shows up in Yerushalayim. Actually, he doesn't show up in Yerushalayim. He sends a messenger to show up in Yerushalayim to say the following. The messenger was named Rav Shake. Hine vatachta al mishenet hakaneh haratzutza zal mitzrayim, asher yisamech isha lahav uvav hachapo unkava, King Paro Melech Mitzrayim, Nechol HaBotichim Alav. Behold, you have placed your trust on the splintered reed of a staff on Egypt, upon which a man will lean and which punctures his palm. That is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, for all who rely on him. That's in chapter 36. So it seems quite clear that such a deal was made, that Israel was, or Yehuda was, looking for Egypt to help, and that Sanherib came to mock that call for help after he sent Cush and Tirhaka, Melech Cush, Melech Paro, Melech Mitzrayim, skittering back to his country. So, although the Radak sees these prophecies as earlier, I see that these, I'm going to stick with my idea that these prophecies are really being delivered but a few years before Sanherib's march in 701. And now, on to chapter 30. Hoy, banim sorarim neum Adonai, la'asot etza velo mini, vilinsoch masecha velo ruchi, leman sifot chatat al chatat. Oy, you rebellious sons. Again, these prophecies are like the ones in chapter 29, which recollect the very first prophecy recorded in this book with the word banim sorarim and hoy. Oh, you rebellious sons, says the Lord, who make plans without my saying okay, who draw up schemes without my will, and as a result of this pile sin on top of sin. Ha'ochim la'redet Mitzrayim ufi lo sha'alu, la'oz b'ma'oz paro v'lachsot b'tzel Mitzrayim. You who go down to Egypt without asking me to take refuge in the refuge of Paro and to take shelter in the shadow or protection of Egypt. Vayalachem ma'oz parola voshet. Ve'chasut b'tzel Mitzrayim lichli ma. But the refuge of Paro will be your shame, and your protection in Egypt's protection will be your humiliation. Ki hayu b'tzon sarav malachav chanes yagiyu. In that it's, that is, your nations, or perhaps his Chizkiyahu's officers are in Soan, or Tanis, and his messengers have even arrived in Chanes. Soan is the famous city of Tanis, or the modern-day San il-Hajar, in the Nile Delta, which is almost, very close to the Sinai Peninsula. You may remember the city of Tanis is where they found the Aron HaKodesh and Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I really can't attest as to the historical accuracy of that movie. One can assume that Chanes is much deeper into Egyptian territory, demonstrating a real commitment to this geopolitical deal, which means not only have you positioned your officers in Soan, which at least is a little close to Israel, your messengers have gone as far as Chanes, into a deeper city in Egypt. Kol hovish al am lo yo'ilu lamo, lo la'ezer v'lo la'ho'il, ki levoshet v'gam l'cherpa. All this will cause shame, relying on a nation that cannot avail them, neither support nor avail. Indeed, it will be both a shame and a disgrace. So what we have set up here is that Israel was making a peace treaty, or not really a peace treaty, more of a war treaty with Egypt, that when Ashur would come, the one superpower, the second superpower would come, Egypt would come and help Israel in its battle against Ashur. The question is, what was in it for Egypt? Why would Egypt play along with such a plan? And that will be the coming psukim. Masa bahamot negev, be'eretz tzara v'tzuka lavi v'alayish mehem, efa v'saraf mofeif, yisu alket efayarim cheleihem v'aldabeshek gmalim otzirotam al am lo yo'ilu. This is a prophecy of the beasts of the Negev. That is what Yeshayahu is calling the people of Yehuda that, as we'll see, are doing deals with Egypt in order that Egypt should save it from Ashur. If you've noticed, we've gone back to the Masa term. This is a little Masa inside the Hoy chapters. And to a certain extent, I believe that there's a mockery here, treating the nation Israel of Israel like the foreigners of the other Masaot, because of the way that they're behaving and the deals that they're striking with foreign nations. Anyway, back to the pasuk. A prophecy of the beasts of the Negev in the southern desert of Israel. Negev is the southern desert of Israel. In the land of narrow rifts and cliff, of lions, roaring lions, of vipers and striking poisonous snakes. They convey their wealth on the shoulders of donkeys. That is the Bahamot Negev, these leaders of Judah, are taking their wealth in packs on donkeys and their treasures on the humps of camels towards a nation that will not avail them. Umitzrayim hevel varik ya'azoru lachin karati lazot rav heim shavet. But Egypt's help is empty and vain. That is why I call them Rahav, and they have shavet. They have stopped. Now, we'll have to discuss what that difficult term Rahav Heim Shavet is. Rahav is used mythologically as a supernatural creature of death and destruction. In fact, in chapter 51 of this book, it is used parallel to Tanin, which are the Leviathans, the creatures or creature that God destroys in order to create order in the world, in order to bring salvation. A similar use can be found in Tehillim 89, in Psalm 89, and also in Sefer Iyov. As I mentioned in chapter 27, these are metaphors. These monsters that God battles down are metaphors for other countries. In the case of chapter 27, it was pretty conclusive that we were talking about Egypt and Assyria. And the prophet is using these mythological descriptions because of their impact. That is, sure, he could just say Egypt, but by saying that they're a Rahav, that they're a creature that God destroys, the impact is much greater. He feels comfortable using these mythological images because the images have already been removed from the religious worldview of the Jewish people. Nobody at the Jewish people at the time, although later, closer to Christian times, they would start to believe again in these mythologies. But back in the times of the prophets, nobody believed in these monsters. They understood them as metaphors. It's like if I say about somebody who could do no wrong, that guy who just walks on water. Not only am I not referring to Jesus, but my listeners understand, and my listeners understand that the reference is metaphoric, but there's no doubt that my listeners understand that my using a metaphor of Jesus does not believe that I am a Christian believer. Anyway, getting back to Rahab and Tila 87, there is a very interesting use. It's used specifically as a synonym for Egypt. In Sefer Iyov, Rahab is brought down by God, and the sense that Rahab is an unjustly proud and egotistical creature can be found also in Tehillim 40 as well. And that's how it's used as a verb in chapter 3 of this book. Yirhavu ha-na'ar ba-zakein, the apprentice will lord over the master. That is, in the wrong scheme of things, rather than the master controlling or leading the apprentice, the apprentice is lording over the master. The sense here, getting back to the word Rahab, is that it is a symbol for Egypt, not only because of the nation's mythical and very often snake-like mythology and theology, but it's also the sense of overweening that Egypt has for itself. And yet, it's really a shavet, which means it's not really going to go to bat for you. It's really, I don't know if the word is lazy, or if the word is it doesn't go all the way through, or perhaps just politically, it's not what it used to be. That old gray mare is not what it used to be, and Asher has become the predominant world power, as opposed to Egypt, which is predominantly not. Atam bo chativa luach itam yal sefer chukah utihi liyom acharon la'ad ad olam. God now commands Yishayahu. Now, come and write it, that is the prophecy, on a slate and carve it into a book, a series of slates, that it should be around for a later day forever and ever. Ki ama marihu banim kechashim banim lo avu shemoa torat adonai. Because it is a rebellious nation, deceitful children, they refuse to listen to the instruction of God. So either Yeshayahu is writing these words, i.e., he's writing, this is a rebellious nation or deceitful children, etc., etc., or this verse explains why he must inscribe the prophecy that he has prophesied before and that he's going to prophesy shortly. They are such a rebellious and deceitful children, I want it down on paper, or in this case, chisel on stone, to make sure that they know that this is exactly what I said, and what I said is what happened, rather than any attempt to do a little bit of a historical revisionism, or you never said that, or you never told us, if only we had known. No, write it in stone so that everybody knows. Asher amru l'ro'im lo tiru, v'lachozim lo techazulan u'nechachot. You know what you should write? They said, or the reason you should write, is they told their prophets not to prophesy, and their seers not to seer. They said, Dabru lanu chalakot chazu mahatalot. Speak mahatalot. Speak tales to us. Prophesy words of humor. This is not just hiding one's head in the sand and knowing that there are prophets around, but saying, okay, I heard what you said, but I'm not interested. This is a mockery of the institution of God's involvement in daily events, much like the nobles were teasing Yeshayahu when he was speaking his speeches, and they said, oh, your speeches are like tzav l'tzav, tzav l'tzav, kav l'kav, kav l'kav. They were just a bunch of children's instructions, no good for us. So here, what they told the prophets is, hey, why don't you just write some nice, pretty poetry for us, and we'll sing and dance to it, but we're really not interested that you give us anything serious. Surumini derech, hatumini orach, hashbitu mipanenu kedosh Yisrael. The rebellious nation continues to say, get off the path, turn aside from the way, the correct way. Take away the Holy One of Israel from before us, a kedosh Yisrael mipanenu. Therefore, lachem, koamar kedosh Yisrael. They said, take the kedosh Yisrael away from us. I'll tell you what kedosh Yisrael actually says. Ya'an ma'oschem ba'davar hazeh v'ativ techu ba'oshek v'naloz v'tisha'anu alav. In response to their asking for the Holy One of Israel to go away, so says the Holy One of Israel, because you have found this thing disgusting and you have relied on frauds and fakery, this seems to be God's name for Egypt, Naloz, Oshek and Naloz, probably referring to their social and religious policies. and you put your reliance on it, lachein yeh lachem avon hazeh kiferetz nofel niveh b'choma nizgava asher pit'om lefeta yavo shivra. Therefore, this transgression of yours that is dealing with Egypt will turn out to be a descending crack in the secure wall, a crack which comes suddenly and unexpectedly. What God is saying is, had you only not done this deal, then everything would have been A-okay. And now that you're doing this deal, the very wall that you think that you are putting up to protect you is going to be cracked and destroyed suddenly, and it will wind up destroying you. Ushvara keshever nevel yotzrim katutz lo yachmol. V'lo yimatzei b'michtato cheres lachtot esh miyakud v'lachsof mayim migeva. And its crack, that is the crack in the wall, will be like the crack of a wine pot shattered with no mercy, where among its earthenware shards one can't find a piece useful enough to stoke coals with, or an oven to stoke coals from an oven, or to scoop water from a puddle. That is, you thought you were building a great thing. In fact, it will be so shattered that there won't be anything left behind from your protection. Ki cho amar Adonai Elohim kedosh Yisrael, v'shuva v'nacha tiva sheyun, v'ashketu v'avitcha tiye gvuratchem, v'lo avitem. Indeed, says the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel, with penance and peacefulness you will be saved. Your strength will be in quietude and tranquility, but you didn't accept it. Now, you could say it's never too late. The prophecy is happening before. Even though there's probably wheeling and dealing already going on with Egypt, the assumption is that Yeshua wants to give them a chance to change their mind. Or it could be that now that the deal is already struck with Egypt, it's really too late. And therefore, God is saying, listen, this is just the word has gone out. There's nothing you could do now. Had you been quiet, had you been peaceful, then you would have been saved. I like to think that there's still a chance for salvation. And that's why God says, "Beshuvah v'nachat tivasheyun," not only with rest, but with penance. That is, with coming back to the place where you should be, which is not in Egypt, but with God here in Israel. V'tomru lo. Chiasus nanus alkein tenusun, the alkal nirkav alkein yikalu rod fechem. Rather, you said no, for on horses will flee. The word nus means flee, but I think it's used because, first of all, it rhymes with horse, sus, nus and sus. But the sense is not that they'll escape from the enemy, but that they will flee from their troubles on the might of these horses. But God says, therefore you will flee literally. And you said on fast horses will ride, on kal nirkav, therefore your pursuers will be faster, yikalu, than you. Elef echad mipnei ga'arat chamishata nusu, ad im notar tem katoren al rosh ahar v'chanes al ha-giv'ah. An elef of yours will flee from the shouts of one, from the shouts of five, until all you have left is the mast on top of the mountain and a flagpole on top of the hill. A flagpole, a nes, is not a miracle in this case. It means a place where you put a flag. One thing to help understand this pasuk is that the word elef does not, it literally means 1,000, but it's the name of a military unit, something like a brigade. An elef is brigade, which may have been much less than 1,000 people. Gidon says in the book of Shoftim, in the book of Judges, that Alfi Hadalba Menashe, my elef is the smallest in the tribe of Menashe. That can only be true if a brigade that was supposed to have 1,000 people can very often be made of much less, what's called a truncated brigade. Also, when the pasuk says you'll flee from one and from five, so one possibility is that if one can't scare you away, then five will scare you away. But I don't know, that doesn't seem right to me. So I think it may be referring to God. I think one may be referring to God. And the first ga'ara that the one will do will mean a rebuke, like Yaakov was go'er at Yosef after Yosef told his second dream about the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down to him. The five can actually be the actual enemy, and ga'ara there literally means military shouts. But either way, the prophecy promises bad news, but with a bit of good news. Because you dealt your dealings with Mitzrayim, and you trusted in the Rahav, so you will be destroyed. However, here in Yerushalayim, there will be a flag to stand as the last station where the remnants, the survivors of the war, can gather. V'lachein yichakeh Adonai lechananchem, v'lachein yarum lerachemchem, ki Elohei mishpat Adonai ashrei kolcho chelo. Indeed, the Lord is waiting to have grace on you. Indeed, he will rise up to show you mercy. Because the Lord is a just God. Happy or wealthy are those who, or satisfied, are those who wait for him. Again, it's the confirmation that even though things are now going to be bad, at least in Yerushalayim, for those who come and rally around God's flag on Har HaBayit, those will be shown mercy. And again, as I said, it seems that nothing here is really cut in stone. It seems to me that the wheeling and the dealing, the trading for riches, their riches for protection, will cause them to be wiped out. However, he's saying, listen, just wait with me and you'll be okay. Yeshayahu is told to write it in stone, I think, so that people will not try to do this historical revisionism and say, well, you never gave us a chance. I think this prophecy right here is the chance. And the fact that it's written in stone is to show the people now is the chance you have because you won't be able to argue about it later. And now God describes the best part of the worst case scenario. Ki am b'tzion yeshev b'Yerushalayim b'chol lo tivkeh chanon yochnecha l'kol za'akecha kishom ato anach. Indeed, the nations that dwell in Zion will surely not cry. God will surely have mercy due to your cries, and he will hear it, and he will answer. Anach, he will answer you. V'natan lechem Adonai lechem tsar u'mayim lachatz. V'lo yikanef od morecha v'ayu einecha ra'ot et morecha. V'oznecha tishmana davar me'acharecha le'mor zeh derech lechubo ki ta'aminu v'chi tasme'ilu. The Lord will supply you with rationed bread and eked out water. And the reason why I'm translating tsar and lachas as rationed and eked out is because this is a positive thing, not a negative thing. That is, you won't be comfortable. The siege is coming, but you won't be starved out either. And at the time of the siege, what will happen? There'll be a transition in your approach to God and his prophets. You will no longer cover up your teachers, lo yikanef od morecha, and face to face, your eyes will see your teachers. Einecha ra'ot et morecha. That is, not only will you hear them, you'll actually go right to them and look at them in the eye and say, what do you have to teach me? And more than that, your ears will hear the word of God from behind you, which means you'll have navis to the back of you and navis to the front of you. They'll be all over the place. And those navis will be free to speak the truth. And what is the truth? They'll say, this is the way to go, even though at times you deviate to the left and to the right. But timei tem, and finally, timei tem et sipui psilei kaspecha et apudat masechat zehavecha. Tizrim kamodavat say tomar lo. And you will defile your silver-plated idols and the gold-adorned carvings. Notice the word afuda, like ephod. You'll scatter them, assumedly that the defilement process, the team A process, included sort of a grinding down to powder, much like Moshe did to the golden calf. You will scatter them like the blood of an unpure woman, and you'll say to it, leave. That is, you'll say to the ashes and to the remnants to get out of here. This is a long parak, and it pays to take a breather or a recap on what we've seen up to now. First of all, from verse 1 to 5, it defines the problem. The powers that be in Yehuda have decided to wheel and deal at a very expensive cost. Their camels and their donkeys are laden with all kinds of expensive goods. And they've made this deal with Egypt to act as their shield against Asher. In verse 6 to 11, the prophet uses poetic imagery to deride these doings, calling them a masa behema, these animals with burdens bearing their riches down to Egypt, and point out that even though God has told them not to do this, they refuse to listen. So here it actually gets to the point, which is, look at what you are, look at who you're dealing, and pay attention to the fact that God is telling you you're doing the wrong thing. In verse 12 to 23, God says, as a result of their rejection of his policy, Yeshayahu will carve in stone exactly what will happen to the people. Total salvation had they only listened, and near total destruction because they're not listening, with God saving only Jerusalem. And it'll be tough, but the remnants of the nation in Jerusalem will survive. The people will then start listening to their prophets and in fact surround themselves with the word of God. Finally, they will cast away their idols. Now, The issue of idols is very strange, since nowhere have we heard that idol worship is the problem in the time of Chizkiyahu. God says they were going to the temple. It's just that their minds were inured against God, and it was all a show. And perhaps that's why the Radak puts these prophecies at the time of Ahaz, because Ahaz was an idol worshiper. However, I'd like to paraphrase what I heard from Rav Soloveitchik. There are more than one way to be an idol worshiper, and worshiping a stone or metal fetish, an object that represents some kind of false god, is not the most sophisticated of idol worships, and certainly not the only one. You can worship money, political leaders, anything can be turned into an idol for worship. A country that you believe will save you, a policy, your own intelligence, which you think is greater than the intelligence of the prophets and the plans of the prophets of God. All of these could be idol worship, and I believe it is to that that the prophet is saying, that when you burn away your gold and your silver, it's not fetishes and the shapes of donkeys and cows and all kinds of things that people pray to. It's the fact that they put their trust in their gold and their silver to save them from the onslaught by making wheels and deals and outsmarting everybody, or thinking that they could outsmart everybody. And that is a form of idol worship as well. And now, to the coming section. After this great battle, where unfortunately few survive, the enemy will be destroyed. And after the enemy is destroyed, then comes the salvation. That's going to be the theme from this part of the Perek onwards. Now, if your ear hears the tones of messianism and your eyes see the shades of the apocalypse, it is no accident. The language is quite hints at apocalyptic, and that this battle of Ashur might be the final battle, even though in the end it turned out not to be. V'natam etar zar'echa asher tizra'at adama v'lechem tvuat adama v'ayad ashen v'shamein yir'eh mikne'echa b'yom ahu kar nirchav. And he will give rain, that is, after Ashur is destroyed, after the remnants have been saved, he will give rain for the seeds you sow in the land, and bread from the produce of the land, and it will be healthy and fat, and your herds will graze in wide and broad pastures. V'halafim v'ayarim ovdei adama v'lil chamitz yochelu asher zoreb varachad uvam mizreh. And the bulls and donkeys will work the land, will eat mixtures of hay and chickpeas, chamitz. Arabs call it hummus, and we call it that as well. And the hay will be winnowed with pitchforks and mizreh, some kind of winnowers. Again, I'm not a farmer. You have to ask your local farmer exactly how hays and mixed seeds and feeds are works. Well, I think that there's an emphasis here on the word adama, 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 in the sense that, you know, you think you're in trouble because all you'll have is Jerusalem. But after the fall of Ashur, you'll go back to your land. And in fact, it will be so rich that you may not remember the bad times. But that's my own insertion, not Yeshayahu's. V'haya al kol har gavoah v'al kol giva nisa'a pilagim yivle mayim b'yom hereg rav bin pol migdalim. And on every high mountain and each lofty hill, streams will stream with water on that day of mass death as the towers topple. And to see how messianic that is, see the last chapter of Zechariah for the cracked mountain of Har HaZeitim and the streams of life of live water, Mayim Chayim, that will descend both east towards the Jordan and west towards the sea. V'haya or halavana ka'ora chama v'ora chama yeshiv atayim ka'or shivat hayamim. Biyom chavosh Adonai et shevra amo umachatz makato yirpa. And the light of the moon will be like the light of the sun, and the light of the sun will be seven times as bright, just like it was during the 7 days of creation. On that day, God bandages the wounds of his nation and heals its broken injuries. And from the healing God, we now move to the destructive God and what he will do to the nation of Ashur. Hine shem Adonai ba mi merchak bo'er apo v'choven masa'a sifatav mala'u zam ulishano ke'esh ochalet. Behold, the name of God is coming from afar with blazing anger and a heavy burden, a burden for others, that is. The word yisa means to lift off sin, as when God forgives. And Masa'a is probably used for when he is putting back on the burden, when he is exacting punishment. Let's continue on with the verse. His lips are full of wrath, and his tongue is like a devouring fire. I would like to suggest that the verse starts with the words Shem Hashem Ba, the name of God is coming, rather than God himself is coming, because of the unparalleled anthropomorphism of God that we have here as a physical warrior of destruction. We're really envisioning like a physical being, almost a mythological god of old that came to wield his vengeance. And because it is so close to anthropomorphism, the Navi is using the name of God to demonstrate that it's a metaphor. It's not God himself, but the name of God. Unculus does this a lot. Instead of saying that God himself came, he said the presence of God or the wisdom of God or before God. I think there's a similar idea to back away from the potential of mistaking this for some kind of physical being. V'rucho k'nachal shotef ad savar yechetzeh l'hanafa goyim b'nafat shav v'resen mat'eh al l'chayei amim. His breath is like a raging river reaching up to the neck. Now the rest of the pasuk is a little difficult, but we'll give it a shot. To shake up the nations and to steer them wrong, b'nafat shav, and put a misleading bridle on their jaws. There is an image in the ancient times, I'm not sure this is what it's referring to, that when they took kings captive, they would essentially drill a hole in the cheek, put in a shackle on the inside of the jawbone so it couldn't be removed, and drag the kings in a procession of shame. I don't know if that's really what's being described here, but the images are definitely there, and it's possible. By the time as God finished smacking them around, this pasuk says, they won't know if they're coming or going. Mat'eh b'nafat shav. They simply won't know what's happening to them. Hashir yelachem kalel hitkadesh chag v'simchat levav kahulech bechalil lavo bahar Adonai el tzur Yisrael. In contrast, the song, apparently the one that you, Israel, or Yehuda, will sing because of this salvation, will be like a holiday eve when it is sanctified, with glad in hearts, accompanied by minstrels up to the mountain of God, to the rock of Israel. Actually, it's kind of a beautiful scene. You can imagine walking through down those steps and then up the bridges towards Har HaBayit, and people are playing flutes and music and lutes, and there's a great simcha all around. It's really quite the image. It exists a little bit in Israel today, and hopefully it will exist even more and more in the times to come. V'hishmi'a Adonai et hod kolo v'nachat zro'o yar'eh b'za'af af v'lav esh okhla nefes v'adzerem v'even barat. So while you're singing in Yerushalayim and playing music, God will sound out his majestic voice, and he will show his laid down hand with rage and anger. I think what that's trying to say is he'll place his hand down on the enemies to destroy them. And a stream of devouring fire and thunder and downpour and hailstones. Indeed, the voice of God is breaking Ashur, the one who strikes the staff. Now, the Mefarshim say that the Shevet Yakem means, or at least some Mefarshim say that the Shevet Yakem means that God will use his voice while Asher is hitting with its Asher's staff. That is, Asher will be making war on Israel, but let's see what happens. This goes back to the idea of tnufa, being shaken around in every direction. The verse seems to be saying that every time Asher lifts its staff to breach the foundation, Musada, of Jerusalem, God will place his hand on the staff of the enemies with drums and lyres. That is, with kinorot. That is, the music that comes out of Jerusalem, God uses that with his voice to essentially smash upon or to hold down the staff of Asher as the staff of Asher tries to break Jerusalem. And with a war of shaking, God will fight them. And I think that the sense is that while the nation is holed up in Jerusalem, it won't have to do anything except sing the glory of God, and God will take care of shaking up Ashur, not in a military way, but in a miraculous way, as described above. Ki aruch me'etmol tafteh, gam hila melech uchan he'emik hirchiv, medura tah esh ve'etzim harbei, Mishmat Adonai k'nachal gafrit bo'araba, because the tofet, or in the feminine here, tifta, has been readied since yesterday, or long since. She, the tofet, has been deepened and widened for the king, for Sancheirev. Its fire pits are well stocked with fire and trees, and the breath of the Lord is like a stream of burning material. that will burn inside of it. This is, of course, referring to the valley of Gay Ben Hinnom, the valley of Ben Hinnom, or in short, Gehenna, outside the walls of Jerusalem. Some of the most horrible kinds of sacrificial rites were performed there. Archaeologists have dug up horrible statues with hands outstretched for babies to be burned on. This, then, would be the fate of Ashur in its final battle against Yehuda and Jerusalem.